for the room is medical student, because the first 10 minutes is medical student level. But for those of you who have been through this stuff, please rest assured that this will promptly move into the realm of the unknown and the mysterious and the advanced, and not walk out thinking it's going to be 60 minutes and very simple. There are several objectives, but one thing that generally pervades people's analysis of troponin is there's a lot of mythology surrounding it. I'd say when I'm on service, about once a day, a clinician tells me something about troponin for which there is absolutely no published evidence to support the statement that they said. But I want to help go through what it is we know about troponin and help, hopefully, for the people who haven't spent much time working with cardiac biomarkers, an opportunity to learn how to use them, and for the people who have spent a lot of time hearing things about troponin and other biomarkers, to help clear up what statements have evidence to support them and what statements are just being made up on the fly by people who have strangely strong opinions for the things they make up about troponin. So they may or may not be true, but we're just going to review the things that we do know about it, and you can take it from there. I have three cases today. The first one is a 67-year-old patient who has very few cardiac risk factors, who comes in with non-exertional epigastric pain radiating to his chest. And on past medical history, only risk factors, hypertension, you know, age, gender, sure. Got a history of reflux disease. Got an extra comma on his medication list, not sure how that got there. Negative family history. Physical examination, completely benign. Got a murmur in a benign area. Chest x-ray is normal. His EKG shows non-specific STT wave changes. Chest pain's gone by the time the patient's here. Okay, so what do you do with this patient? And I'm not going to ask everybody to jump in. You can kind of choose here between options one and two. One option is to say, really, this is reflux disease, go away. Another option is to say, you know, your EKG is not perfectly normal, you have a risk factor. It felt bad enough that you actually came into the hospital. Let's do something to really make sure this is not an MI. And it sounds a little silly. We have lots of patients who we admit for this rule out myocardial infarction. Some things about it are great. First of all, it's a profit center for the hospital. Even Jacobi makes money on this diagnosis. You get a whole admission, the patient's out in 8 hours. You get to bill for a stress test. It works very well for us for getting paid. And you know, the defense of doing this comes from a series of people and studies, mostly out of Columbia, that have found that actually about 15% of people coming in with this rule-out MI admission actually are going to have significant coronary artery disease that could benefit from a more aggressive approach to treating the coronary artery disease, although 85% of them will go home. The director of gastroenterology at Northwestern a few years ago was playing tennis with an internist friend, and during the tennis game, he starts getting pale and diaphoretic. And the internist friend says, "What's up?" He says, "It's just my exercise-induced reflux." And the internist's first thought was, "Well, you know, you're the director of gastroenterology at a major center. You ought to know what exercise-induced reflux would be." As they play tennis a little more, and the guy gets really pale and real diaphoretic, and the internist says, "Well, why don't you get checked out?" And it turns out that he had severe three-vessel coronary artery disease that I guess seems somewhat similar to his exercise-induced reflux. So this is why you might have a strategy of admitting these people and doing some tests to make sure that the atypical chest pain they're having is non-cardiac as opposed to an acute coronary syndrome. Okay, right, yes. Why are we starting with this very simple case? A very basic slide in any... this is very, very basic. We will get more complicated. And I don't want to sound like a kindergarten teacher, but or a third year epidemiology and test interpretation person, but when you get troponin, it's because you want to rule out myocardial infarction. You know this, you've heard this many times, but just want to reemphasize that you get it because you have a low to intermediate pretest probability for myocardial infarction and you want to bring your post-test probability lower. If you think there's no way the patient's having an MI, then troponin is not an indicated test. If you think it's absolutely certain the patient's having an MI, somebody presents with 60 minutes of crushing substernal chest pain and they have 4 millimeter ST elevations and leads 3, 2, and AVF, and they're pale and diaphoretic and hypotensive, then if your troponin comes back normal, you will rightly ignore it as you rush the patient to the cath lab. So it's really, it's a diagnostic test that's been studied only in a fairly narrow population. A diagnostic test has a receiver operator curve, and I'm sure you have differing levels of familiarity with the receiver operator curve, but it is one of the best ways of analyzing the accuracy and clinical utility of a diagnostic test. A perfect diagnostic test shoots straight up to here and then shoots straight across, maximizing the area under the curve. The coin flip test, the is this an acute myocardial infarction, heads yes, tails no, that test goes right along this diagonal line here. The gray bar is standard troponin T. That is what they use at Montefiore and Einstein, is the standard cardiac troponin T. It is a very inexpensive assay. It is not patented. It's just cheap at this point. There's 18 different providers of that test. It has worse receiver operator characteristics than the 4 ultra-sensitive troponin assays. Here at Jacobi, we use the Siemens Troponin Ultra, which is this red line among this pile of lines that are doing much better. Troponin, we already went through this, the name of the condition, the troponin helps you diagnose. Too many slides hammering on this very basic point. Troponin is to help you diagnose acute coronary syndrome, which is what happens when a coronary artery plaque ruptures, causing partial or complete blockage of a coronary artery. And this is what troponin has been developed for. When they made those troponin diagnostic curves, it was to ask the question, does troponin correlate with you having this problem? Where you got your atherosclerotic plaque that ruptures and you start getting blood clots forming and disappearing inside the middle of the coronary artery. This is the acute coronary syndrome cause of acute myocardial infarction. This is the number one cause of death in the United States of America. And troponin is there to help you figure out whether or not your patient has this. And that is the only condition that has been validated for use in. We have a boatload of studies that have validated troponin for use in this scenario. And when we use it in any other situation, when you get troponin on everyone showing up in the emergency room, not just those who are ruling out for MI, when you get them in every critically ill patient who can't talk to you and maybe has subtle EKG changes, these are not reasons for which troponin has been validated. And when you get a troponin value in these people, it's tricky to know what to make of it. And I'm sorry, we'll get into that a little bit later. A troponin has a sensitivity and a specificity and a positive predictive value and a negative predictive value. Troponin has quite good sensitivity. This is what we're dealing with. You can ignore this number because this basically just means detectable troponin by RSA. Got an 89% sensitivity, so it's quite good as a rule-out test when you're using 0.04 as your upper limit. It has a terrible positive predictive value. Now remember, positive predictive value is asking the question, among people who have a positive troponin, how many of them are having acute coronary syndrome? So if you check troponin on everybody, 32% of them who have positive troponin are not having an acute coronary syndrome. Which is a lot. Sorry, I'm bouncing around a little bit.
So I'll throw this out for the world. The first patient comes in, the first troponin is negative, the chest pain stopped 2 hours ago. When do you want to check troponin again? Somebody want to shout out an answer? What's that? Yeah. And that actually is definitely the correct answer at Montefiore, where they're using this gray standard assay, which has really quite terrible accuracy in the first 4 hours after symptoms begin, but starts to get better at some point after 4 hours, and there's another jump again somewhere about 10 hours after symptoms. It's less clear what to be doing with our new ultra high sensitivity assays, because we're here, we're the best line here at Jacobi, we're the red line, and actually the test doesn't get that much more accurate with time. The one that we're using here, Monty's, gets more accurate with time. Ours, not that much change. It's still reasonable to repeat troponin, and sort of everybody does, and sometimes it does come back positive newly again. But you sort of see that it's doing better 4 hours out than 2 hours out. But it's not as clear what to be doing with our new ultra-high sensitivity troponin assay. About, you know, the old check troponin 0, 4, and 12 hours after admission is now maybe a little less clear. That was certainly what to do with the old assay. With the new assay, not certain, but it's certainly reasonable in everybody to check troponin at least 4 hours after onset of symptoms to benefit from this slight improvement in diagnostic accuracy. So your patient has ruled out. Question is, when do you check troponin again? Do you put in daily troponin orders, check every day? As far as I'm concerned, once your patient is ruled out, you're done. Quit checking troponin. Unless the patient gets EKG changes and angina and chest pain, and now you have a new reason to want to rule out MI again. It's a basic point, but I'm only making it because it's quite common to see daily troponin orders checked in people in Jacobi, and I don't really know why we do that, except that it's easy to put the order in. And then your patient has ruled in. How often, so let's say you have a patient with acute coronary syndrome and their troponin is positive. How often do you keep checking? Again, oftentimes these people will get troponin measurements daily. But, you know, say somebody rules in, we know they're having an MI in their circumflex territory. And on presentation, their troponin is 5.0. If the next day it drops to 0.05, or the next day goes up to 500, I don't know how that would actually change management. I certainly haven't seen any studies guiding how even these four orders of magnitude different troponin values would change management. So we're an academic medical center, and if you want to construct your troponin time curves for your acute MI, that's fine with me. It costs the hospital not very much money. We buy troponin, our troponin assay from Siemens in ultra bulk, so it's actually a pretty cheap test to do. But I have no idea how, at least from a cardiac point of view, how to interpret fluctuations in the troponin after you've ruled in. Other people give me advice about how to do it.
But sometimes attending ones in the CT will ask, what's the troponin doing? And then you say, it's trending down. And then you say, good. And what does that mean if it's like, if you're not going to check troponin? So if you like troponin like 10,
So this question, all right, so here's our first question of people asking, what do we do in a certain troponin scenario in which the troponin measurement has not been clinically validated? The answer is, it has not been clinically validated. I don't know. I mean,
when would you get to
you know, the people who are selling us RSA are trying to convince us that you only need two sets. The Siemens people are trying to say, RSA is so great, gets so accurate so quickly, only need two, one at baseline and another one 4 hours after presentation. That's what the manufacturer says. It's still national guidelines don't yet accept the manufacturer's recommendation. National guidelines are hours 0, 4, and either 8 to 12, but those guidelines were written based on this assay. So if you believe the manufacturer, then just 0 and 4. If you believe the national guidelines, which were written for a different test, 0 and 4 and 8 to 12. We're in a little bit of limbo there.
What the proponent and the change of management is, it's like you already decide the patient has a positive troponin, but the patient is, you already decide the patient has a good test. And then troponin is actually goes higher instead of like the patient in AC goes higher instead of like going down. You still have significance within the change.
Your patient's ruled in, and now your patient is still ruled in.
What is that going to be like in different in management if troponin goes up in AC?
If there's ever been a clinical trial that showed that a troponin changing from 10 to 10,000 is something that we should act on clinically differently than a troponin that goes from 10 to 5, I'm not aware of it. Both should be treated with maximal treatment for acute coronary syndrome. And it's not like if you go from 10 to 10,000, then you should get an LVAD and heart transplant because of that. It's not if it goes from 10 to 5, you should withhold treatment for acute coronary syndrome. Both scenarios should receive maximal treatment for acute coronary syndrome. You can keep checking. It may be of academic interest. It doesn't cost much money, but it does not affect clinical decision making. Or if it does, it is based on some understanding of troponin that is unique to the brilliant clinician that has not been published in the literature. Alright, so again, it's very difficult for me to go through a day on service without hearing some statement about troponin that has, that's a strongly held belief that has not been, as far as I can tell, really backed up with scientific studies. And so I'm going to go through three of sort of the most illustrative sets of comments. And so for you guys who haven't been working through the whole world of troponin misinterpretation, I almost want to just ask you to leave now because you know exactly how to deal with troponin. There's nothing more to learn. And the rest of this is going to be about clearing away cognitive cobwebs that have developed. But we love to have you. Alright, case number two. Similar to the first case, and it's a 67-year-old man. A little different because now we're up to three risk factors. And the patient's history is he opened up Brownwald to the page on acute coronary syndrome, unstable angina, and just read that back to you as his history. I mean, just perfect history for acute. This is, if this isn't unstable angina, I don't know what is. And now he's having, this has progressed over the past month to the point that now he gets substernal chest pressure at rest. And he gets partial but not complete relief of the chest pressure with nitroglycerin. Oh, and also I made his family history positive. The last guy's family history was not positive. So he's got four risk factors. His blood pressures and heart rate are a little bit marginal. He's got an S4. He's guaiac negative. His EKG, and unlike the previous patient where the changes were atypical, these are EKG changes of ischemia he has, and the troponin is pending. So this is one I want everybody in the room to vote on. One best answer, I want everybody to raise their hand. I'm going to go through an order. Should we start heparinization, not prophylactic dose, but heparin, therapeutic, goal PDT 60 to 80, or if you prefer, because this guy's kidney function normal, enoxaparin, I don't care what you choose. So you're waiting for the troponin to come back and you're deciding whether or not to start enoxaparin. Who thinks we should start enoxaparin using 0.1 micrograms per milliliter of troponin cutoff? Please raise your hand. Okay. 0.5? Okay. 5? Okay. None of the above? Hey, you guys are good. Fantastic. Yeah, that answer is correct. None of the above is correct. Why? Let's back up a little bit. So you got three types of acute coronary syndrome. All three relate to coronary artery plaque rupture. This disease can cause either unstable angina, non-STEMI, or STEMI. It's the same pathophysiologic process. The treatment for them, all three, is very similar. There are some subtle differences. But same underlying pathophysiology. And so you're right. In all three of these, we've now diagnosed acute coronary syndrome in this patient before checking the troponin, which means that we treat with heparin, regardless of the troponin value. If the troponin comes out negative, then we say the diagnosis is unstable angina, a treatment, a condition for which you give heparin, and it's been found even in the post-aspirin era to be life-saving. If you have a non-ST elevation of myosis, unstable angina, where you can detect troponin in the bloodstream, treatment's the same as for unstable angina. So the difference between the two is just whether troponin's positive or negative, but the treatment for the two conditions is exactly the same. And then STEMI, which goes for, again, you don't care what the troponin is. You heparinize and rush to the cath lab. Just said that. Okay. And so, yeah, case number two, patient with unstable angina. You don't care what the troponin level is. You give heparin. On to case number three. Case number three is a little bit, yes?
Cath for case number two?
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Yes. Unless there is a contraindication to catheterization. Part of the treatment for all of these conditions is cardiac catheterization. In this case, within 90 minutes of presentation, in these, within 72 hours or sooner if the patient shows signs that shows certain high risk factors. All right, case number three is tricky. The doctor who admitted case number three just walked into the room. It's actually not true. What happened was I wrote this talk a week ago, and then a patient with exactly the same history as case number three got admitted to the CCU 5 days after I wrote this. It was a nice illustration. Case number three is just like case number two, except instead of diabetes, he's got ulcer disease. And the history is the same. The history is a month of progressive unstable angina. Except again, the guy doesn't have diabetes, he's got a known history of ulcer disease. Doesn't have a family history, unlike case two. So just two risk factors instead of four, like in case two. The patient's all the way tachycardic. The exam's pretty much the same, except the patient is pale and the patient has guaiac positive black stool. And a hemoglobin hematocrit of 6 over 19. So severe anemia. And the EKG is exactly the same. The EKG shows EKG changes of ischemia. And we're still waiting for the troponin. So I'm not going to make you guys vote because I don't want to make anybody look foolish. That said, there was a prolonged discussion when this patient showed up, just a patient with an almost exactly the same history showed up in the emergency room on Saturday night. There was a prolonged discussion about whether or not we should heparinize this patient. And actually the patient who showed up this was Saturday night, had on CT a confirmed 6 millimeter duodenal ulcer seen on CT. The guy had been exsanguinating blood out his rectum. And the ER was calling to ask if they should be giving this patient heparin because he's been having unstable angina with positive troponin. And, you know, I decided to give this talk, and I made up this case before Saturday, but I've been really feeling demoralized by confusion surrounding troponin. And I'm very glad that you give me an opportunity to vent a little bit, all of you. Thank you. You're making me... Is this there? So this guy has angina. This guy has ischemia. This guy has ischemia because this patient is anemic and probably a little hypovolemic also. This patient is having angina because you can't get enough oxygen into the myocardium to perfuse the myocardial cells well enough. The myocardial cells don't feel enough oxygen, which gives you angina. Just to drive home the point, in case two, who really needs heparin, and is, we'll just say they really needs heparin right away, there's angina, there's ischemic changes on the EKG, etiology in case 2 was acute coronary syndrome, in case 3 was bleeding, and heparin in case 2 is it's slightly improved survival, in case 3 it could probably cause imminent death. And is the troponin positive or negative in case 2? It doesn't matter and it doesn't affect your management. Is it positive or negative in case 3? It doesn't matter and it doesn't affect your management. Remember, troponin was for case 1. Troponin was to rule out MI. In these cases, although the troponin is doing interesting things, it does not guide your management, and the troponin was not validated for use in these scenarios. Yes?
If you have a patient that can chase you, the history of hemorrhage is slow in the past 3 months.
Okay. So the question is, patient with acute coronary syndrome who also has a contraindication to heparin. So you've got an indication for heparin and a contraindication. So let's just ramp that question up to the reductio ad absurdum answer. You have somebody who had a large hemorrhagic stroke 3 days ago. I'm changing the scenario a little bit. 3 days ago, a large hemorrhagic stroke, and right now has a massive pulmonary embolism causing hemodynamic instability and is not a candidate for CT surgery / IR intervention for some reason. Do you give heparin or don't you in that scenario? And the answer is nobody knows. If you give heparin, the patient dies. If you don't give heparin, the patient dies. And you can work through this thrombosis / bleeding, do you give heparin sandwich in all sorts of permutations? But it always goes down to a which one scares you more. You're always weighing a risk-benefit analysis in this, and it's very patient-specific. And the answer is I'd want to know more details, and also your patient's prognosis is poor once you get into having to ask the heparin versus no heparin mushing situation. It's bad, and you need a patient-specific answer. Right, this was just to remind all of you that 32% of people who have troponin at Jacobi, who have troponin checked just randomly essentially, are going to have a positive troponin and not having acute coronary syndrome. Just bringing that back up for the people who missed this earlier. We have one of the best and most expensive troponin assays available, and yet still our positive predictive value is only 68%. When you're indiscriminately checking troponin. Very good sensitivity, terrible positive predictive value. Those of you who have been working here for a while have noticed this. I'm sure all of you have taken care of somebody with troponin who does not have acute coronary syndrome. All right, we worked through number one. Number two, and usually this is given with this is a very interesting question. There are a new type of myocardial infarction called a type 2 myocardial infarction. It's the same as demand ischemia. So, once upon a time, demand ischemia is not called a myocardial infarction. And then the hospital lobbyists got together and said, you know, if we could bill for demand ischemia the same that we can bill for myocardial infarction, we'll get paid a lot more because myocardial infarction gets paid a lot. And so they lobbied the ACC and the AHA to change the definition of myocardial infarction to include this condition, demand ischemia, which is demand ischemia not due to acute coronary syndrome, to give it the same name, the name myocardial infarction that we used to reserve for acute coronary syndrome. Now we've changed the name so that we can now bill Medicaid and Medicare more when somebody shows up with this type 2 myocardial infarction. So we'll just go through the myocardial infarction types as defined by the ACC, AHA, and the European Heart people. Type 1 is acute coronary syndrome. This is what we're all thinking of when we're thinking of acute MI or acute coronary syndrome, is type 1. Type 2 is just demand ischemia, and if I had my way, this would not be called a myocardial infarction. This would be called demand ischemia, and that we just bill appropriately and truthfully. But yeah, they changed the definition so that this to make it more confusing in hopes of improving billing. Type 3 is just the same as type 1, except you die before troponin comes out positive. It's basically an autopsy diagnosis. Type 4 is we touched you with a catheter and then you had troponin. And type 5 is we touched your heart with a knife and then you had troponin. You don't need to learn these types. Please don't memorize them. They're just pointlessly confusing. They can be useful in research studies. They are not useful in clinical decision making. There are other things that I'm hoping that you'll memorize in this talk. This is the one that I hope you will forget. Last year, joint European Committee and ACCF and AHA and WHF Task Force. Okay, I threw that one. All right, so, but where is the troponin coming from if it's not coming from the heart? And this 32% of people who have troponin but no ACS, what do you do? I mean, the standard answer is call the cardiology fellow and ask if you should start heparin. But we want to try to get you a little bit more sophisticated today. So you have somebody whose pretest probability for acute coronary syndrome was so low you shouldn't have even ordered troponin. Or something that also often happens is you get the demented 80-year-old person who comes in for hypoxia and they can't give a history and the EKG is nonspecific. You check the troponin there and you're trying to figure out what to do and it comes back positive. Well, we don't know is the short answer because nobody's studied the use of troponin in this scenario. But, alright, I'm not going to just say we don't know and therefore no recommendations. We're going to try to give you something a little more thoughtful than that. So the first thing is some people in British Medical Journal in 2004 published, if I could find the only published in literature, differential diagnosis of troponin elevation. And they only came up with 50 things. And this actually was a woefully incomplete list. The number four most common cause of troponin elevation in a study that actually looked at frequency is pericarditis, and they forgot it from their list. And actually, just looking at this, I can think of at least 10 more conditions that caused troponin elevation that didn't make their list. So, sort of the short answer is, you know, it's not just scorpion bites. It's really lots and lots of things that can cause troponin elevation other than acute coronary syndrome. And if you want to look this up, you can look in the British Medical Journal. It's really kind of useless. It's so broad. So when I get the consult of what do we do about the troponin, where it's not clearly acute coronary syndrome, I need some way for me to think through the differential. And I came up with this as a fellow. And it's the main advantage to this is it's reasonably comprehensive and it's really easy to remember. So this is mine. This is, you can feel free to think this is the lamest thing you've ever heard, but it works for me, sharing this with you. We're going to go through, in each category there are two causes of, there's a differential of two within each of the six causes, so we'll go through them quickly. Oh, that was easy, acute coronary syndrome. Good. Also, pulmonary embolism. It's some people did a case study of a serial group of patients admitted for PE to a major hospital, checked troponin in all of them, and found that 30 to 50% of them had troponin. So it's probably reasonable. We always want to be suspicious of pulmonary embolism, that somebody comes in and has troponin elevation for no good reason. It's probably worth racking your brain. Gee, actually, could this be PE? And for these, you should give heparin. Really, the only other reason to give heparin for an elevated troponin is Kawasaki syndrome, which you won't see. But this is it. You shouldn't just be giving heparin to all troponin, just those indications. Next indication is trauma, electrical or mechanical. The mechanical gets particularly tricky when you're doing chest compressions on somebody for a cardiac arrest, then afterward you check troponin and it's positive. You don't know if the troponin's positive because they had acute coronary syndrome leading to the cardiac arrest, or if it's positive because you were just jamming their rib cage into their epicardium. It's tough to know. I know I said at the beginning that there's only one validated time to use troponin with a few tiny exceptions. One actually is, I don't know if there's any emergency or future emergency medicine people here, people with severe chest trauma ought to get a troponin check. This has been validated. It's an excellent screening tool at arrival to see if people have suffered either cardiac contusion or, worse still, a rupture of a cardiac vein, leading them to risk of getting pericardial tamponade very soon. And you can't ask these people if they're having chest pain or not, because they just have massive chest trauma. Of course they have chest pain. So when somebody smacks into an embankment at 50 miles an hour and their airbag goes off, check their troponin, and if it's positive, they need a stat echocardiogram. And may end up needing further procedures right away. And please don't give them heparin. Okay. This next one, all right, so this category, I admit, is overbroad, but it helps this is the trickiest part to work through. In anybody, simply increased oxygen demand alone. If you get enough oxygen demand alone, you will get ischemia and troponins. And if you get not enough oxygen getting delivered to the myocardium, you will get troponin. All of these things alone give you troponin. In particular, there have been some studies confirming this. So once upon a time, if you showed up to the emergency room with ABNRT, and you're a 25-year-old woman, which is the demographic that gets ABNRT, they'd go to the emergency room, they'd say, oh, you got ABNRT. And they'd, well, it's, you know, back before they had troponin, they do carotid sinus massage on you, that's changed, but, and convert you from ABNRT back to sinus, and then send you on your way. But at some point, people said, let's start checking troponin. And these people found that most of the young women who come in with ABNRT going at 180 beats a minute have troponin. So somebody said, oh no, they have troponin. Where's it coming from? It has to be coming from the heart. Well, so let's cath them. And so they took a bunch of people who were coming in with this and cath them and found, you know, who had the elevated troponin, and found 21 patients in a row who had totally normal coronary angiograms and ABNRT. And yeah, it's just tachycardia alone. And then another case series found this also is sufficient to cause troponin. So, you don't need to kill myocardium in order to have troponin. This has been showed many times. I'll actually think I'll get into this a little bit more later. Sorry. And also, in patients with severe left ventricular hypertrophy, if your LV is 22 millimeters thick, pretty much all you have to do is take one hit of albuterol, and that should be enough to give you measurable troponin in the blood. It should give you just enough tachycardia and positive inotropy. And again, if... Yeah, this was a study looking at people who got echoes and had... no clinical evidence of myocardial ischemia. They just looked at people with the biggest left ventricles. Lots of them had troponin. And this is probably because if you have a severely hypertrophied left ventricle, you have chronically severely elevated myocardial oxygen demand. You need more oxygen to perfuse a thick ventricle. Because these patients are very fragile. Just tiny changes will make them ischemic enough that you can detect troponin in the blood. Is our thinking for the explanation for this. Right, and aortic stenosis is sort of functionally the same as LVH when it comes to this. Right, next category, sick. A lot of people have sepsis during their septic episode. Troponin is detectable in the blood. Afterward, they get better. Their heart is fine. We don't know why this is. Our leading hypothesis is that sepsis causes some troponin molecules to degrade inside the myocardial cells, and degrade small enough that they can come outside the pores in the myocardial cell membrane and then be detected in the blood. That's our best guess. Yes?
Under these circumstances, do you not have cardiac death? It's just leakage?
Yes. Well, I want to be careful with the term leakage, but we confirm that the myocytes are not necrosing. The troponins are breaking down into smaller bits and coming out the cell membrane. Is our best guess for why this goes on in sepsis. Plus, the septic patients are going to have demand ischemia too, so it's some mix of demand ischemia plus this change in the troponin molecule size. And this is also a little bit of a large diagnosis range, the autoimmune / infiltrative. It's rare, but it causes troponin elevation when you're getting amyloidosis or autoimmune attack of the heart. Yes?
However, all these septic patients are labeled and not a state of vision.
Well, unless they make ST elevation. Oh, they are a type 2.
No, they are not a ST elevation. Amount.
Yeah, well, and you can bill for that.
Infarction, right?
Well, hospital gets paid more. Yeah. It doesn't, you know, we don't rush these people to cath. You don't treat them for acute coronary.
Well, that's afterwards, they need to get ischemic workup, at least that was my understanding. But when they get better and they go out to the hospital, they have to be treated as if they had coronary.
We'll get to the subject at the end of what to do with discharge for somebody who had elevated troponin and no ACS. Definitely, it's a good point, and we will get there. And then, if you get a large stroke or a large brain hemorrhage, you can get troponin elevation. We're pretty sure we know the mechanism that the stroke causes you to make large amounts of norepinephrine, which actually cause bits of the myocardium to necrose. And it's been proven repeatedly on pathology studies. You also get EKG changes in these people. It's a marker of poor prognosis from the stroke. It's not something we really know how to manage other than with a beta blocker. And then finally, the annoying category. There's lab error, which happens a lot. And also the chronic kidney disease people. You know, everybody with chronic kidney disease is going to have coronary artery disease. It's not quite true. The vast majority will have coronary artery disease. A lot of them are also going to have elevated troponin. And so you don't know if you're helping them. With the mice? So what happens is if you live near mice, you can develop antibodies to some antigen that's commonly found in mice and mouse poop. And these antibodies interfere with the ELISA-based troponin immunoassay that's used just functionally everywhere. And if you suspect this, there's actually a thing you can do. You can add heterophile anti-mouse antibodies. You can take a blood sample, divide it from one patient, divide it into two. To one, you add heterophile anti-mouse antibodies. The other one, you leave it the same. Check both of them for troponin. If the one without the antibody shows troponin, and the one where you added the heterophile anti-mouse antibodies to counteract the anti-mouse antibody is then troponin-free, then you have your diagnosis. It was messing with the ELISA immunoassay.
We had a patient
when
I was an intern.
Yeah, that was... I remember that. That was great. Yeah. Yes.
With CKD, do you have to be patient both troponin A and troponin T, or only troponin C?
The one thing we know in the chronic kidney disease patients, it doesn't matter, either one, they'll both be elevated. It's not like you do one, then you should check the other. Most of them will have normal CK. CK is not renally cleared, troponin is renally cleared. It's really tough to know what to do for those people. I mean, the real question, yes, they should be on a statin if they need it. They should be on aspirin. They should be on a beta blocker. The question is, should you cath them or not? If they're having acute coronary syndrome, cath them. But if they're having atypical chest pain, should you cath, shouldn't you cath for these elevated troponin?
The one that we have here to call is a troponin I, right?
You missed the beginning. We'll come back and fill you in at the end. Right. Here's the full six category troponin. I like to think of troponin without acute coronary syndrome as a positive RPR without syphilis. You know, one of the joys of that is nobody says, yeah, but where's the RPR coming from? But there's a broad differential diagnosis for RPR without syphilis. There's a broad differential diagnosis for troponin without acute coronary syndrome. And it can be useful to make the point to you, if you have troponin elevation, that your patient is sicker than you thought, and you should think some more about some possible etiologies, things in your differential that you might have been missing. But it's, you know, doesn't mean your patient needs cardiac catheterization. And certainly troponin was never validated for this purpose. Just use this to help you refine your differential diagnosis of patients. And now your question, so what do you do for somebody who gets troponin without acute coronary syndrome? Well, again, you already want to be maximally treating hypertension in everybody. You want to have some LDL treatment goal, which may actually change. You may decide to change your LDL treatment goal from 160 to 100. I don't know. Should you cath these people? We like it. We're not doing enough caths. Of course, we cause cath complications. So if you look at expert recommendations answering your question, so you got up-to-date's answer, which is, we have no idea. We have my answer, which is, just go ahead and give aspirin and beta blockers in the absence of contraindications. And then you have Quadramed's recommendation, which is give aspirin and beta blockers in the absence of contraindication. I think this is reasonable. Aspirin, unless you have like fulminant extreme ulcer disease or severe bleeding or thrombocytopenia, is probably going to be harmless. And beta blockers for most people are going to be fine. You want to control hypertension anyway. Right. And now, where is the troponin coming from if it's not coming from the heart? Where's the RPR coming from if it's not coming from the syphilis? So one thing you can do is you can take one mouse myocyte and in vitro, deprive it of oxygen for 15 minutes, which is not enough to cause cell death, and then give it oxygen again. And it's still alive, and you can measure the troponin fell out of it. So, point here, you do not need to infarct a myocardial cell to develop troponin. There have been multiple ways demonstrated, both in humans and sepsis, and in mice mouse cells in the dish, to show that ischemia alone can cause troponin release without causing infarction of the myocardial cell. Somebody asked, so then why are we calling it a myocardial infarction when they come in with sepsis? And the answer is either because we're confused or because the billing office is asking us to do it because we get paid more. You can also take a rat heart and just increase the preload and then get troponin, then just from increasing the preload. Probably the same thing is happening in pulmonary embolism. Pulmonary embolism is probably causing an increase in right ventricular preload. That's probably why we see troponin in pulmonary embolism. And this is an incomplete list, but just an important thing to remember, particularly just I need to distribute this around the emergency room. Troponin does not equal heparin. This is an incomplete list of cases of situations where giving heparin to someone with elevated troponin can cause death within 24 hours. And if anybody has anything else they'd like to add to this list, this was just me brainstorming for 5 minutes. Again, it should really not be used as a decider of whether or not to give troponin. Troponin should not be used to help you decide whether or not to give heparin, although we use that frequently. Another comment that I get often is, yeah, but the troponin is 12. In my experience, that's too high to be demand ischemia alone, or 20 or 40 or whatever. The only indication I know where there's actually been an established upper limit to troponin from a certain event is from ICD shocks. And I'm pretty sure that in most of us, if you were to totally exsanguinate us, just take all of our blood and put it into like a reservoir for 15 minutes, and then put it all back in 15 minutes later, I'm guessing we'd make troponin in the thousands, and that would just be an ischemic event. So I don't know where people say, no, it's not demand ischemia because the troponin is N number. I hear that about once a week, and I don't know where people are getting it. And at the same time, a very low troponin is not helpful either. If somebody's having ST elevation MI and troponin 0, you still treat full ST elevation MI. You just figure for some reason you're not making troponin. Some people have anti-troponin antibodies. Sometimes you check too soon. You still need, and sometimes, I won't go into why, there are other reasons why in a STEMI troponin can be 0. The one thing that these non-specific troponin elevations are useful is looking at how soon your patient is going to die. And this has been demonstrated most robustly in acute coronary syndrome, but there have been 4 other syndromes where the degree of troponin elevation has been correlated with your risk of dying of that condition. This is sort of the classic within acute MI. This is not our troponin ISA. Don't these numbers look like ours, but they're not ours. They're different troponin ISA. And it's not like you're going to go up to somebody and say your troponin was 5 to 9, so your 42-day mortality is 6%. Mrs. Garcia, I'm just letting you know. And there's a question of troponin versus CK. Troponin has an advantage over CK and a disadvantage. The advantage is that it has better diagnostic accuracy. Back to the receiver-operator curves. CK is this blue line here that's doing pretty terribly for its receiver-operator curve, whereas troponin I, what we're using, does great. CK maybe does a little bit better at 12 hours than at 3 hours, but they're pretty close. But there's a problem. There's something you can get out of CK that you can't get out of troponin. You may want to be monitoring your patient for reinfarction after they've come in. Somebody has acute coronary syndrome, they infarct, and they can't really complain of angina to you because they're 85 years old and demented, or they're intubated, or whatever. You want to know, are they having another second new acute coronary syndrome? The test to do in this case is serial CK monitoring, not serial troponin monitoring. Because if you have an MI here, then 72, 96 hours later, your troponin's still high. This is the troponin. This is the troponin level over time with a confirmed acute coronary syndrome. This is the CK curve, and it's actually a little controversial about what's happening between hours 3 and 12 with CK. But it's pretty clear after 12 hours, after the event, CK levels plummet back to normal. So if you want to monitor for reinfarction, checking the troponin every day is a waste of the troponin lab assay, particularly because we have a much better and cheaper assay available in-house, CK. Anybody who says we should continue following troponin to prove that it comes down, I think must have forgotten that we have CK in the hospital. It's simply the wrong test. Yes?
I would just like to know what
that can be useful. That is useful for this. That's useful for prognostic stratification.
But just as soon as it starts coming down, you just stop.
I don't even, as far as I'm concerned, I don't care as much about prognostication as some people do. Because again, it's really tricky to come up with a situation where if you're in this category from your acute coronary syndrome versus this, that you need any different treatment. Everybody needs aspirin, statin, a beta blocker, a reasonably prompt cardiac catheterization, an ACE inhibitor, and Plavix for 6 months. Maybe a stent, maybe bypass. And it doesn't matter which group you're in, you still need it. But, you know, when you document that your troponin peak's greater than 9 using this troponin assay that we don't use, you can say, Mrs. Garcia, I just want to let you know that your 42-day mortality is 7.5% as opposed to some other people who are here in the hospital for whom it's closer to 1 to 3%. It does tell you that. Personally, I don't care. Other people care. Oh, I had a funny cartoon. Questions?